Hey, listeners, it's 2024, and we are so excited for everything ahead this year. If you haven't done so already, make sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get access to bonus episodes. We've already released 18 of them, and they come out twice a month. Plus, you can get access to ad-free episodes and our private Discord server to hang out with other members of the CashLack community. That's patreon.com/curbsiders. Paul, did you hear about the coffee beans that were having a comedy show just between friends?
Is there a punchline or was that it?
No, Paul, it was a light roast.
Oh, gotcha. Excellent.
What do you got? Because we're in Beantown, Boston.
Oh, good stuff. I should have done a baked beans pun. So I asked ChatGPT to write a pun about the American College of Physicians. Matt, why did the American College of Physicians choose a stethoscope as their logo?
I don't know.
You're going to be thrilled about this. All right. Because they wanted to make sure they were always in tune with their members' heartbeats. They've got the pulse of the medical community. By the way, you don't listen to a pulse, ChatGPT.
This is so much pandering. That's such pandering by ChatGPT.
So wholesome and gross. Yeah, AI.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly CashLack, Moral Hospital, and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we are responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
All right. Well, welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, joined by a lot of friends here who we'll introduce in due time. But this is our first of two recap episodes from ACP 2024. We are in Boston in Beantown. I couldn't find a baked beans pun, so get off my back, audience. And Paul, that was good. That was pretty good use of ChatGPT. Yeah. Paul, can you remind people, what is it that we do on the Curbsiders?
Sure. Usually we are the internal medicine podcast that uses expert opinion to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. But this time around, we are the experts, kind of. We're reporting on what the experts are talking about at ACP. A million sessions, and we went to all of them. So we'll be explaining some of the highlights and the pearls from ACP 2024 this first day, and then a second one, we'll recap what we picked up at the end.
Yeah, and that'll release. Well, there'll be a little time between the two episodes, but this one is the first part of the conference that we attended. And since we don't have a digest this month because we're here at the conference, we have with us the great Dr. Nora Taranto, who is the editor in chief of the digest. Is that your title? I don't remember. You gave yourself the title.
Yeah, I gave myself the title.
I mean, like, we want you to have
it. It comes with
that.
A crown, I hope.
It does.
You know, I haven't received it yet, but.
By the way, you can do this in Academy of Medicine, by the way. This is a career tip. You can just name yourself director or something.
Oh, yeah.
Make things
okay,
up. No
great.
One checks. So
I'll just add things to my CV, slip them in. It'll be great. Yeah.
There you go. Okay. Also with us from Curbsiders Teach, Dr. Molly Heublein.
Hello.
Hi, Molly.
Great to be here. I'm very happy to be here.
And you can keep the mic because we'll go to you for your pearls first. Dr. Chris the Chew Man Chew from Curbsiders and, of course, Curbsiders and Dr. Rahul Ganatra from our hotcakes episode. So we will all be going around talking about some pearls, starting with Molly. So, Molly, tell us a session you attended and what did you learn there?
Yeah, well, I attended a number of good sessions today, but I'm excited to recap two of them. I'll start with one that was Clinical Pearls on Cardiology and Pulmonary Medicine. The cardiology part was done by Dr. Michael Cullen. And so I'm going to use some of your techniques here, Matt.
Okay.
All right. So you've got somebody with atypical chest pain, and you're trying to differentiate. Is this
CAC score?
It's not CAC score. Is this truly angina? If their chest pain gets better with nitro, that means that it really was ischemic. Is that right?
That's got to be true.
Yes, you're on it. So apparently we're not actually supposed to be saying atypical angina because it's confusing. And so we should be saying possible cardiac chest pain, if we truly find out or think it's ischemic, or non-cardiac chest pain. Because atypical angina is a confusing term and, many times it's not actually heart related, so it's not truly angina. And the speaker, Dr. Cullen, highlighted that nitroglycerin really is not helpful in deciding, the response to nitroglycerin, if that helps relieve the chest pain, is not helpful in determining if a patient really has angina. And he cited a study that showed that nitro relieved chest pain in 35% of patients who actually had ACS, and it actually relieved the chest pain in 41% of patients who did not have ACS.
Super helpful.
Yes, super helpful.
The important thing is their chest pain got better.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, In a third of people. And then moving on to pulmonology, that was Dr. Megan Scrondon and Scrodin, actually, I think. She talked about a few different cases, but one that I thought was quite helpful was thinking about if you have a patient with COPD, thinking about if they may also have asthma overlap and being careful to treat the asthma if that's the case. So, for example, if you have someone with COPD alone, you might have them on a LABA/LAMA. But if they maybe also have asthma, you would want to make sure that you optimize the inhaled corticosteroids as well. And she recommended thinking about using an exhaled nitric oxide testing, which is a non-invasive measure of eosinophilic inflammation and has a good positive predictive value for diagnosing asthma.
And we were talking about this, Molly, Paul, you're both primary care physicians. Is this a test that you're ordering when you're ordering like your standard PFTs?
It sounds like not as often as I should be, because I feel like so many patients, like there's such an increase in COPD asthma overlap, which I just don't think enough about probably. So I should probably be doing it more often.
Yeah. And then there's that non-asthmatic eosinophilic bronchitis, which I'm pretty sure that test can be used for as well. But this, I had not thought about using it to help figure out if someone has COPD asthma overlap. That's a good pearl. That's something that I actually may try doing for.
I have never ordered it. So she did have the caveat that it doesn't have a good negative predictive value. Mm-hmm. So if it's low, that doesn't rule out asthma. And she highlighted that smoking and using inhaled corticosteroids are associated with lower fractional excretions of nitric oxide. So just kind of being aware, it's only helpful if it's positive. And then I feel like this is something I should have known, but she also was talking about in patients with advanced COPD who have exertional hypoxia, but not resting hypoxia, using home oxygen does not improve their quality of life or their function. I think I knew that it didn't improve mortality, but I was hopeful that it would improve their 6-minute walk test or, you know, their help them feel better. But unfortunately, it does not do that.
Good luck convincing patients that if they think they need it. But, you know, it's one of those things that I think we probably have some people on oxygen that don't really need it because of that, because they're doing the walk test. And that's how a lot of patients qualify for oxygen. So I don't know, quite know what to do with that, Paul.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. It's that has been my experience, is they actually, you're required to document the walk test specifically to get the supplemental oxygen, which is the thing that is not necessarily all that helpful with. So yeah.
Yeah. The insurance companies haven't caught up to the evidence in that area. Did they talk about like any practical tips for that? Or are they just saying?
They were just saying, don't do it. Don't. Yeah, it's not helpful for patients. And she actually had felt like in her experience, for some patients, having the oxygen actually made their quality of life worse because they're kind of tied to a machine or they're nervous to go on longer trips if they don't have a concentrator. And so she was discouraging us from prescribing that, which I actually just did 2 weeks ago. So
to bring it, yeah.
I suppose that
yeah. And Dr. Leah Witt on our COPD and older adults episode, that's one of the points she made, that it can be like isolating for people, and also risk of fall over the oxygen tubing and things like that. So make sure people really need it. But
yes,
it's a tricky one.
Yeah.
Anything else from that session?
Nothing else from that session. And then the other one that I wanted to highlight was an update on current clinical guidelines in colorectal cancer screening with Dr. Amir Kasim and Dr. Wanda Nicholson and Dr. Timothy Wilt. And they were highlighting the American College of Physicians 2023 colorectal cancer screening guidelines, which differ from the ones that we more typically follow. I think most of us use the United States Preventive Service Task Force guidelines and are offering our patients 45 to 49 colorectal cancer screening now. And they differ in that they say that clinicians should consider not screening asymptomatic average risk people from 45 to 49. Shared decision making, but that they were saying that it's really a minimal net benefit, and the risk in this population is small. And, you know, I think the USPSTF recommended lowering the screening age partially because we're seeing this increased rate in younger patients. But they highlighted that the absolute rate increase was very small. It was a 15% rate increase for colorectal cancer screening in that age range from 2016 to 2021. But the numbers were tiny. It went from 29 per 100,000 to 33 per 100,000. So only a 4 per 100,000 increase, which may not be worth screening.
Right. And we were talking about this offline, Paul. I think it's because it's hard to capture people at age 50, and a lot of times they might not get it until a couple years later. So this just gives us more lead time to get people a colonoscopy around the age of 50. But I don't know what your thoughts are.
No, I agree with that. I also, which this should not govern how we practice medicine, but about the medical legal implications of now having two conflicting guidelines and what happens if you happen to miss an early colorectal cancer because you followed one versus the other, and what do you do with that, and which guideline carries more weight. So I don't quite know what to do with it, I'll be honest. And they had some thoughts about the screening modalities as well, right?
They did, yeah. But I would agree with you. I don't think this is necessarily practice changing for me. I will still be offering my 45-year-old's colorectal cancer screening.
But if you forget, you can say you were following.
Yes.
Following
or I won't feel as bad about chasing them down to convince them.
Yeah.
And then they also specify that they do not recommend using stool DNA, CT colonography, or serum screening testing for colorectal cancer screening. And they specifically state that those have increased cost and reduced specificity compared to the other modalities like fecal occult blood testing and colonoscopy or sigmoidoscopy.
I still think that, there's commercials for that test now, the stool DNA test. So that one I've been getting asked about a lot noticeably since those commercials of that little box that comes up and knocks on a guy's door
and demands
tells him it's time. Yes.
There's that SNL skit people can look up.
Okay.
It's a little scary.
I will have to check that out.
Do you feel like people are equally willing to do the stool testing and the colonoscopy, or do you feel like it's easier to convince and take? Because I feel like in my experience, people take some time to be willing to do a colonoscopy, whereas kind of doing something where they can do it at home, even if they do have to like transport stool somewhere, which they do have to do for some of these stool testing kits, is a little bit easier to do.
Yeah, and their guidelines kind of cover this as well, that it really should be a discussion about what the patient's preferences are, and that patients could change their mind throughout. So if they start with fecal occult blood testing for a few years, they could switch over to colonoscopy. I would say in my experience, it's really variable. Some people, want the best test, even though we don't have clear evidence that colonoscopy is clearly that much better than...
Which is shocking.
...than a fit. But, I think, it's nice to be able to have options to say, this is more involved, but you only have to do it every 10 years. This one's quick and easy, theoretically.
Yeah, the USPSTF authors made the point that the test that the patient completes is the best test for colorectal cancer screening. And I will say anecdotally, I've had the home test then prompt patients to undergo the colonoscopy. So you kind of get there regardless. And I've seen sort of more enthusiasm regarding colorectal cancer screening with increased options. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure how I feel about taking it off the table unless we have a really good reason to.
It also takes so long to get scheduled for colonoscopy in a lot of areas that that can be hugely problematic from getting people to the test they're going to do.
Or even at home.
Yeah.
You need transportation back. You're not driving yourself. And that can be a barrier in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, they're certainly not recommending taking the FIT off the table. Yeah. It's just the DNA testing.
Let's go on. I know you and Nora were both at the multiple small feedings of the mind. There were some oncology pearls about the checkpoint inhibitors. We did an episode on that a couple years ago, but anything you wanted to bring up from that one? So Nora, you're well into oncology fellowship at this point. So what reactions should we think about early on and sort of over the course of treatment?
So Molly and I went to the multiple small feedings of the mind. One of the areas that they covered was cancer survivorship topics, and Dr. Narjust Flores presented on this topic. And one of the areas that she focused on was toxicities from medications that patients are increasingly getting and are actually increasingly surviving with. So patients will have received checkpoint inhibitors, for example, and many of them will be surviving for long periods of time after having received checkpoint inhibitors. And so there's increasing awareness of what the side effects are. And also with the nuance and the understanding now more than 10 years ago that many of these drugs that are new, we understand longer term side effects in a different way than we did 5 or 10 years ago. And so for the checkpoint inhibitors in particular, she pointed out that kind of the way we're understanding the side effects is evolving, but skin rash toxicity tends to occur earlier than other toxicities that are checkpoint toxicities. And then colitis, so diarrhea. And the diarrhea can be very profound, lots of like liquidy diarrhea, cramping. And then the endocrinopathies, so the thyroid issues, which can be hypo or hyperthyroidism, and all of the other adrenal and endocrine problems can occur.
And these are temporary and reversible?
Great question. So no, some of them can be treated and should be treated promptly. And so that's one of the reasons I think this was a great topic for this conference, because these are things that people may be coming to you as their primary care doctor with, saying, oh, yeah, like I'm having these new symptoms. And if you aren't thinking about the possibility that like even 6 months out, a year out, I've seen some of these happen like 2 years out from checkpoint inhibitor therapy, that they need to be treated promptly. And she was saying, I don't know whether any of you have done this, but she was saying, if you're ever in doubt, just start them on prednisone, 1 mg/kg. Have you done that in primary care, or are you going back to that?
All the time.
Okay.
For almost anything. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like even some oncologists, like they want more workup before they'll do that. So, but it is true that like the longer you wait, the more you have a risk of things being permanent and not reversible. And a lot of the endocrinopathies in particular are not reversible. And so people need hormone replacement for them.
Yeah. And I think it was helpful as a PCP, you know, hopefully these people are seeing their oncologist regularly, but sometimes if it is months out and the patient might not be aware that this is a potential complication from their treatment, they're likely to come to me and say, you know, I have this new cough or I have this diarrhea. And so just being aware of those potential later term effects.
This episode is brought to you by Beginly Health, the job matching platform for every physician and advanced practice clinician. Are you tired of recruiters calling and texting you nonstop? Wondering if that salary offer is competitive? Are you curious about job prospects across the country? Or do you just want to find the right job without fear of your personal info being leaked to the internet? Beginly Health gets it. You want control over your job search, your information, and ultimately your future. And you should. That's why Beginly created a new and better experience for job seekers that confidentially matches you with jobs you're actually interested in. And recruiters and employers can't access any of your contact info until you decide to share it with them. Their matching algorithm is designed to weed out the noise and show you the jobs that match you as a whole person. But that's not all. Beginly offers a unique approach to job searching, letting you set your own priorities. Whether you value salary, living in a specific location, or working with an underserved population, Beginly helps you find the perfect match. Imagine a dating app, but for your career. Plus, it's completely free for you. Beginly is powered by your preferences, not basic filtering. Their platform takes your personal, professional, and location preferences into account and then continuously works for you in the background to present jobs and employers that match what you're looking for. Beginly understands that you're busy, so they push new job matches directly to you, making it easy to see the latest opportunities to explore. You can think of Beginly as your own virtual headhunter. They take on the heavy lifting of your job search. Beginly also centralizes all of your information in one place, allowing you to track and rank job opportunities as you explore them. For every role, you can see the cost of living, population data, and what the housing market is like in certain zip codes. Plus, you get AI-driven questions to discuss with employers, so you always know the right things to ask. Ready to take control of your job search? Visit Beginly Health, that's BeginlyHealth.com/curbsiders to get started. Beginly Health, powered by preference, connected by passion.
The one thing about survivorship that she was talking about that just kind of struck me, where she was talking about how patients, like, they have a diagnosis of cancer, so they're just like, she's like, YOLO. They're like, they're smoking, they're drinking, they're out partying, and then they're like cured from their cancer, and then they're like suffering from the consequences of some of these things. So she's just like, don't forget to like talk to them about smoking cessation, because then she's seeing patients who had a breast cancer and now come back with a lung cancer and things like that. I just thought it was interesting, the lifestyle things. You know, I'm a big lifestyle person, Paul.
So I hear. So. Mm-hmm.
And or like other cancer screening, which like in the treatment for their one cancer, they will not have gotten the other cancer surveillance that really they could have been getting for 5 years while they were undergoing cancer treatment. So that's something that kind of falls between the oncologist and the primary care doctor and often, I think, does get forgotten.
I was survivorship broadly. Like,
right,
just
exactly.
Fall apart. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the Chew Man, Chris the Chew Man Chew, with some smoking cessation pearls. And Chris, who was giving this session? Do you have
the name? It was Hasmina Katheria. It was the 7 o'clock session on the first day. So
where were you when you were listening to that?
Well, I started off with brushing my teeth. So I watched on live stream.
Team, Chris. That's what really
But I made it there in person by the end, so it was great. It was
okay. So you definitely weren't in the bathroom.
We went through a lot of things. I think one thing that was brought up, and I really feel that, you know, I think we've talked about it on episodes before, is the Eagles trial. And I think it's always reasonable to bring this up again with so many of our patients who are smoking and need help with it. You know, there is safety and efficacy in using medications like varenicline and bupropion in patients with psychiatric disorders. So I think the Eagles trial was one of the trials that really showed this. And I think it's just good to reiterate that and for people to know that, hey, just because they have a psychiatric disorder, don't take this off the table for them.
Yeah. The other one that, and I think it was that trial as well, people talk about the vivid dreams. And actually, I think nicotine replacement therapy has can affect dreams just like varenicline can. But people say, like, I don't want to take it. I heard it messes with your dreams. But nicotine replacement therapy can do that as well. So it's just one of those things where if somehow varenicline got a ton of bad press. And so a lot of patients don't want to. They're like, I heard I can't take that because I've been depressed. Or, you know, I my friend took it and they had really vivid dreams. So I don't want to take it. Sounds kind of fun, Paul. I don't know.
Yeah, like good dreams or bad dreams?
No, just
that's
intense.
The question.
Yeah. Depends. If it's like Freddy Krueger, you know, then maybe.
Double up, do the varenicline and the patches and just have yourself a whole 8-hour vacation at nighttime.
Okay, Chris, what about e-cigarettes? Anything on that in the session?
Yeah, what I liked about talking about e-cigarettes is we just haven't had a lot of studies looking at e-cigarettes in terms of, we now know, you know, some recent studies showing that, yes, e-cigarettes are good for smoking cessation, but now we know that people then just are now addicted to e-cigarettes and can't get off them. So what do we do with those patients? And we previously didn't have a lot of studies showing what is evidence-based that we can use to help people with e-cigarette cessation. So there were some studies that were presented talking about varenicline and counseling for vaping cessation. So it looks like there are some studies. We can put those in the show notes that it was a true randomized 12 weeks of varenicline plus counseling versus placebo plus counseling with an N of 140. And basically there was high continuous abstinence with varenicline. So I think we have good evidence for that. And also just plain old evidence of just using regular nicotine replacement therapy and counseling for vaping cessation as well.
Yeah, when we talked about this on Hotcakes recently, we were looking this up, and the one of those pods that comes with nicotine that goes in the e-cigarette devices has as much nicotine as someone get from like a pack of cigarettes. So it does really replace one nicotine addiction with another. We think this is still harm reduction based on like the recent editorials. Even the experts are saying that now. We should mention that the two studies we talked about, there was one by Auer et al. From 2024. That was in New England Journal. That one, the e-cigarettes versus the counseling plus vouchers, Paul, and that one held firm. E-cigarettes, you know, did help. But the one where it was by Lin et al. From 2024, and I think it was in one of the internal medicine journals. That one was recalled. Rahul, do you remember it was like data issue?
Yeah, it was a coding error, and it was actually, the retraction was kind of proposed in a letter by the author. So that's not quite as bad as, you know, a retraction for fraud, and we'll have to sort of stay tuned to see if there's a reanalysis.
And this doesn't like topple the whole e-cigarettes being something that could be beneficial thing. That was my take home from. It's not like we now had to take back everything that good that was learned about e-cigarettes. This was just one study.
I think that's right. I mean, it is important to sort of look out for retractions of studies that you're basing your decisions on and to sort of see what happens. Paul's shaking his head in disagreement. But no, I don't think this topples everything. Whether, you know, e-cigarettes are going to be less harmful than cigarettes with respect to specific outcomes in cardiovascular disease, pulmonary medicine remains to be seen.
Yeah. Okay, Chris, what
makes certain intuitive sense to me, by the way, because like there's still the behavioral element. So the e-cigarettes will take the place of that and then transitioning to varenicline after. So the trial that would be interesting to me would actually be having a period of transitioning to e-cigarettes, then following up with varenicline, like actually doing that in a structured way. And I would bet you see some success with that.
Well, Paul, watch this transition. So, Chris, cigarettes are bad for you, but I heard that walking 10,000 steps a day, I will live forever. Is that true?
Well, so that's a great question. So
it's not actually, Chris. You don't have to endorse this.
And did the consult guys talk about this?
Yeah. So, you know, I went to the apparently great talk from the consult guys is Gino Murley and Howard Weitz.
Sure.
Yes. Gino and Howard. You know, there's some great guys from the Annals of Internal Medicine. So, you know, a lot of times they'll bring up a question and then they say, is it, you know, do I need a bus to Smith or not? And so one of the questions that they brought up, or at least the consult they got, was the patient said, hey, do I really need to make 10,000 steps? Everyone keeps on recommending this. And what was great was they sort of went through the history of what the 10,000 steps, where it came from. And so the Tokyo Olympic Games were in 1964. And basically Japan was in the middle of this fitness craze at the time. And this company called Yamasa decided that this term they have is called, now, I'm probably going to mess this up. Manpo K, which means 10,000 steps or something like that. It just sounded right. So that's how they landed on 10,000 steps. So there was absolutely no evidence base for when they decided on 10,000 steps. And so this is from 1964. So that was, 60 years ago. And since then, they haven't had a lot of really good studies to follow that up to say, hey, this is what's going on. So we haven't had a lot of good studies since that time that they decided 10,000 steps was going to be what we're going to do for, you know, recommend to our patients. And so recently we've actually had quite a few studies come out. And the one that they brought up during our discussion was this Steens et al. From the Journal of American College of Cardiology. And so basically in that study found that as few as 2,517 steps, so, you know, 2,500 steps per day, can be associated with an 8% reduction in all-cause mortality, while 2,735 steps per day can achieve 11% reduction in cardiovascular disease risk. So they found that the optimal daily step count for minimizing health benefits to be about 8,763 steps for a 60% reduction in all-cause mortality, and a 7,126 step for 51% reduction in cardiovascular risk. So basically, they found that it sort of plateaus after that point. So, you know, if you round things up, you know, shoot for 8,000 steps a day. You can do 10,000 steps, but probably you're not going to get much more benefit after that.
So, Rahul, what about you? What session did you attend?
Yeah, I went to Dr. Jerry Smetana's update on new medications in primary care. This was a really useful session. He talked about four novel drugs that have recently gained FDA approval for a couple different indications that are common in primary care. The first medication he talked about was vonoprazan. I actually don't know how to pronounce that yet. Probably going to butcher that. We'll go with vonoprazan, I think.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay, so we're going to
coin it on this podcast right now.
Yeah. This is a new class of medication that's been approved for refractory GERD. So you all have a sense persistent symptoms on PPIs are really common. This medication is a novel class of medications called a PCAB, potassium competitive acid blocker. And these drugs are more rapidly absorbed than PPIs. They have a longer half-life and somewhat more potent. And the bottom line on the data for vonoprazan is that they're more effective than PPIs for patients with severe erosive esophagitis. And they have similar efficacy for people with garden variety GERD. The important things to keep in mind when using this drug, this will reduce absorption of drugs that need an acidic environment for absorption. And there's also some CYP3A4 interactions. And not surprisingly, this is expensive. It is only going to be approved for 6 months of use currently, not for continuous use. So it's an option for patients with refractory symptoms of GERD or severe erosive esophagitis. He also talked about a drug that we have discussed on our show before, fezolinetant. We discussed this in episode 403, which was a hotcakes, and episode 409 with Dr. Monica Christmas. This is a non-hormonal therapy for hot flashes, some of the vasomotor symptoms of menopause. So, you know, hormonal therapy is the most effective treatment for vasomotor symptoms, but it does carry risks that some patients will, you know, fairly be uncomfortable with. There are alternatives like gabapentin and SSRIs, but those are not really that effective. So fezolinetant is a new medication. It's a neurokinin receptor blocker. And this works fairly well to reduce the frequency and severity of menopausal hot flashes. Headache and transaminase elevations are kind of common with this medication, so you gotta watch for those. But it's good to have a new option in armamentarium for menopause.
Yes, and Molly was telling us, because Molly deals with a lot of women going through this, and they're not thrilled when they find out they have to get this 3, 6, and 9 month testing of their LFTs for the first year that they're taking the medication. I think that's probably going to go away because the side effect wasn't that common in the trials. And, you know, we'll see as more people are on this. It's still really expensive. They're advertising it on TV, direct to consumer. So I'm sure people are coming and asking about it. but I have not yet prescribed it for anybody.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Chris brought up before we recorded that the concern about transaminase elevation came from reports of related molecules that showed this in preclinical testing. And Dr. Smetana pointed out that very few patients had severe elevations in transaminases from this. So hopefully that will go away. He also talked about the RSV vaccines, and you know, there's a lot more that he said than we're going to go into here. But one thing that I thought was kind of interesting is that on the market currently, there's a vaccine from GlaxoSmithKline and a vaccine from Pfizer. Moderna is also developing an mRNA vaccine for RSV, so stay tuned for that. That's expected to gain FDA approval in the next year or so, and you know, there's been some concern about neuroinflammatory side effects with the RSV vaccine so far. So, you know, it's hopeful that the Moderna version might be safer. So stay tuned for that.
And one of the pulmonologists, and I think this was in the multiple small feedings talk earlier today, was saying she thinks it's going to be for people under 60 in the next few months with high risk, like lung disease, so really bad asthma or COPD, it's probably going to be approved for them as well, because you're really trying to target the populations that get sick from this are really young kids and older folks who are sicker. And so they're expecting that. I'm curious. I guess they're just going to extrapolate. To my knowledge, it hasn't been studied in that population, but so that might be coming down the pike as well.
Yeah. Yeah, we did discuss RSV vaccines on a prior Hot Cakes, and we discussed the trials Renoir and Matisse that studied the RSV vaccines in older patients. Mm-hmm. And currently only the Pfizer vaccine has approval for administration in pregnant women in the third trimester. But yeah, I don't know if there's data that I don't know about, which is always possible, or right. if that data will be an extrapolation.
Yeah. And the GSK vaccine is the one that's adjuvanted, and there was increased risk of miscarriage, so it's not approved in pregnancy. But that's where we're at with that. So we'll continue to follow that on Hot Cakes and the Digest, I'm sure.
Oh, you know we will.
Okay, what about, I think there's one last agent to talk about.
Yeah. The last novel agent that got FDA approval in the last year is a new option for depression. And this is a medication called Gepirone. And this medication is a 5-HT1A partial agonist. And this is more similar to buspirone than the SSRIs. And this drug has kind of a storied past. This was previously rejected by the FDA 3 times. And apparently the 4th time is a charm.
This is a major red flag.
Yeah. So, you know, the history of this is online. You can Google it, and it's a fascinating story. But Dr. Smetana pointed out that this medication might have a role in treating patients who can't tolerate SSRIs due to side effects. Dizziness and nausea were the most common side effects with this medication. Importantly, there is no weight gain, no fatigue, and no sexual side effects. So, you know, stay tuned for more information on how this medication is going to end up being used. Dr. Smetana wondered if this might be something that might be end up getting used off-label for sexual dysfunction with or without depression.
And in our next batch of episodes, we are going to try to do a depression update and talk about some of the newer therapies. That's something on our list. So that should, sometime in 2024, we should have another depression episode, which is long overdue. What was next on the agenda? I think cannabis, the harms of cannabis. Is cannabis good for the heart, Rahul?
I think we should talk about cannabis. I can see Paul just like chortling with glee. Yeah.
Cannabis.
So there was another great talk at this conference, What's New in Addiction Medicine? And this is with Dr. Charles Reznikoff. And he gave an update on a bunch of different pieces of addiction medicine. The first thing that was discussed was cannabis. And just, you know, an oyster farm of interesting pearls in this section. So there's increasingly convincing observational data that cannabis has sympathomimetic properties and is a coronary vasoconstrictor and a peripheral vasodilator. So this is the basis behind why it's concerning that cannabis might have cardiovascular implications. Paul, can I get your take on that?
Sounds bad.
He's always been skeptical of all the health benefits of cannabis. And every time there's cannabis articles, he's always sending them out to us on our internal Slack channel. That's why we knew Paul would always want us to talk about this.
I feel like this is you trying to protect my career, which I appreciate. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Reznikoff did talk about some of the benefits of cannabis use. And one of the things he mentioned that I thought was just really actually important to recognize was that many people just use it for pleasure because it's fun.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, absolutely worth recognizing in the balance of risks and benefits of why people do anything. And there's many people who use it for sleep regulation. There's some thought that it might help with nightmares and PTSD. He did talk about the risks of rebound insomnia with stopping cannabis. And then, you know, we've all had, you know, some familiarity with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome at this point. A lot of other interesting pearls on cannabis.
What about the pre-op? Wasn't there a pre-op? I thought that was something that I wasn't aware of and you had mentioned. Yeah. So should patients smoke cannabis right up to the time they're getting rolled into the operating room?
Why no, Matt? They shouldn't. you know, I'm not familiar with the data on this, but he did cite a study showing that preoperative cannabis use is thought to increase perioperative adverse cardiac outcomes like more than fivefold. So this is, in my mind, if true, this is an easy lever to pull to sort of counsel patients that, hey, before an elective surgery, you know, it's worth it to curb the cannabis use. So that kind of fits in my mind with, you know, cannabis having vasoactive properties. He did mention that the increase in MI, coronary disease, and stroke are, you know, on the order of 1.2 to 1.4 times the risk of non-use. But he noted that that's about an order of magnitude less than people who smoke tobacco. Mm. So still clinically relevant, but, you know, not as bad as smoking tobacco.
Okay. Paul, let's go to you. I guess we're just going straight around the table
sure.
here.
I do it. The cannabis thing, I just want to say, just because even in states where it's used medically and not just sort of legal in general, like I don't think that the vetting process or the counseling process around its safety is probably very thorough for the patients who are being certified for medical use. Like, oh, I have my card. Oh, for what for? Anxiety? I'm like, okay, great, good. This seems legitimate. So I do think like this, the adverse effects and the cardiovascular effects are really worth talking about. So I think that's just, it's compelling and important information. And if someone discloses it to you, which I think patients are much more comfortable doing these days because it's just so prevalent, it's a chance to at least have a conversation about the safety because they probably didn't get it when they were certified.
As we do with alcohol, tobacco, any other substance people are using.
Yeah, and he also did point out that the incidence of use in the like elderly and aging population is going dramatically up, or at least we're capturing it much more than we used to. And so I think that that's a big part of this increased understanding of the incidence and risks from a cardiovascular perspective, just that the population is changing probably. Yeah.
So Paul, so tell us a little bit about what did you learn about ILD and who was giving the talk?
Yeah, this was, I went to ILD for the internist. This was given by Kevin Wilson from Boston University School of Medicine, and just a really nice overview in terms of when to suspect it and what to do about it and what pulmonologists are talking about. So the broad strokes, if you have a patient who has an unexplained cough or dyspnea or interstitial ground glass opacities that you can't explain otherwise, it might be time to start thinking about ILD. And he gave sort of all the classes of the acute causes of ILD, like hypersensitivity, pneumonitis, and CTD related ILD and drug-induced and acute eosinophilic and acute interstitial pneumonia. But in any case, say you have an acute presentation of what you think is ILD, the debate the pulmonologists are having is how soon and how aggressive should be about diagnostic testing versus when should you just initiate treatment for these patients to help them. And it sounds like the pulmonologists don't agree. There's not a whole lot of consensus about this. So the diagnostic testing, it's done through bronchoscopy for the most part. And there's different things they can do. They can do lavage, which the presenter liked. You can do transbronchial forceps biopsy. You can do these transbronchial cryobiopsies, which apparently pathologists like, but are not widely available necessarily. And if you're really hell-bent on getting a diagnosis, then you can even do a surgical biopsy. But the patient ends up with a chest tube. They're in the hospital for a little bit. And then if they have significant ILD, it can make it much, much worse. So a plus side, you get a great diagnostic yield. The downside is it can make things worse. And does it matter? And the fact of the matter is he's going through the treatment for all the different subcategories of ILD. It turns out it's like 40 milligrams of prednisone for almost all of them. So the one point that he made, which I think is just important to consider, is if you think that it might be scleroderma-related ILD, prednisone can actually precipitate a renal crisis, recognizing that we as internists are probably not going to be firing off the prednisone for suspected ILD, but just something to be mindful of. And the treatment course is usually at least a couple of weeks. He talked about anti-fibrotic treatments for ILD too. And most of these conditions don't progress to fibrotic lung disease, so there's no urgency to start them on these anti-fibrotic medications. And again, we're not going to be doing this unless you're talking about IPF, which by definition is fibrotic, and then it's a different conversation. The other thing that he talked about are these sort of acute exacerbations of ILD, and these can be due secondary to things like pneumonia, which is the most common scenario, but also these patients often have comorbid heart failure, so they can have heart failure exacerbations on top, or you can have ILD that has its own exacerbations. And the takeaway point here is that prognostically, that's an awful sign. And the last thing that I thought was super interesting in this talk is this, as we're doing more lung cancer screening and more CT scans, we're seeing more findings that are consistent with ILD in patients who don't have symptoms and are not presenting for that specifically. And what do we do for this? These are what they call interstitial lung abnormalities. And so the point here is you should think about the risk factors for progression, of which tobacco is one, age greater than 60, and family history are all really important prognostic indicators. And these patients probably merit relatively close following. So if you find this, even if they don't have symptoms, you should probably do a follow-up scan like 3 months, and then 6 months, then annually thereafter. This is not something that you can just be like, well, they're not symptomatic, so I'll just park it, forget about it, because they can progress. And ILD, as we know, can be dire. So it's good to sort of get a sense of their tempo and get pulmonology involved very early on if you think that this might be what's going on. So good talk overall, nice consolidation of things that we've talked about in prior episodes. This podcast is brought to you by Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Irez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Irez, selfishly, it would mean that he could spend more time with Gabby, who is spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There's no training time, no onboarding, and no extra mental burden. All of the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on doing what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you. Charting is critical and necessary, but it steals your focus away from your patients, eats away at your time with your family, and keeps you up at night. The burden of always having another chart to complete drains every clinician. Freed is an AI scribe that makes charting go away. It does your soap notes for you. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patients' instructions. Charting is done before your patient walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like a human scribe, and it will never quit on you. Freed is loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It is HIPAA compliant, takes 30 seconds to learn, and costs only $99 per month. And you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of Curbsiders can use code CURB50 for $50 off their first month.
I went to, with Chris Chuman, we were at the nephrology updates talk. Our speaker was Dr. Michael Ross, and he talked about this APOL1-mediated kidney disease, which actually, something I hadn't heard of, apparently it's very common in Black patients because it is a genetic mutation that has some association with protection against African sleeping sickness. So sort of he made the analogy to something like sickle cell disease. Chris, did you heard of this before?
I had never heard of it before. And it seems like maybe we should have, because it seems much more common than we think.
Yeah. So the reason that he was presenting this is because a lot of patients who are classified as like hypertensive kidney disease, when they do this APOL1 testing, they might actually find genetic markers saying that this might have been the cause of their end-stage kidney disease. And there is a drug now targeting this. I guess apparently it causes an FSGS, and the drug was called inaxaplin, and they were looking at it. This is still early stage, but in an early stage study, it reduced proteinuria by almost 50% in APOL1 high-risk genotypes at 13 weeks. So this is something just to think about. You might be hearing about it. Not yet practice-changing, but certainly something that I hadn't heard about. Now there's a drug that might be coming to market for it eventually, so something we should know about.
Yeah, it's going to be expensive, luckily, but at least from a primary care generalist perspective, maybe coming up, we might be the ones doing that genotyping, at least before they go to nephrology.
The other thing that came up this year in the talk was cystatin C or cystatin C, and it has some advantages over the regular creatinine because it doesn't depend on muscle mass and some of those other non-kidney factors that can make us trip up with creatinine a little bit. The big take home there is I think it's going to become more available, and I think we're going to be using it more. The equations that estimate eGFR, the most accurate ones use both creatinine and cystatin C to estimate the eGFR. So if you can order it, in some patients it might be helpful. The patients, he said, where it might be most helpful, the adults over 65 who have like CKD3A, right? So these are people with eGFR 45 to 59 by your creatinine equations. Those patients, some of them are like worried, I have stage 3 disease, what, that sounds bad. But he said a lot of those patients, nothing bad's going to happen to them, but you can use the cystatin C to help classify them. Are they higher risk or lower risk? So that might be an area where you might use it.
I think some of the things that we just have to keep in mind nowadays, at least for now, is that it's a little more expensive and that many places may not have it in-house. So
yeah.
I think some of our institutions, if we have to order it, it's a send out and comes back in a couple of days. So.
Yeah. You know, the way that I was thinking of it, Paul, is if I'm seeing an outpatient and, you know, it's someone that's worried, oh, I have CKD 3A and I'm sending their 6 month or 12 month creatinine, I can just send this to set and see. And it doesn't matter to me if it comes back in a day or 7 days.
Right.
So that's probably how I would use it. The other session that I wanted to highlight was the testosterone replacement therapy session with Dr. Bradley Anawalt, who did a great job. And he talked about this continuum of testosterone, saying that this was his most important slide. And it was basically just like a continuum of severe hypogonadism all the way up to eugonadism. And the people with severe hypogonadism are most likely to benefit from testosterone replacement therapy. People with eugonadism are not going to benefit. And in between, you benefit based on how severe it is. So I think that was a useful thing. And not a way I'd been taught. He didn't give hard and fast cutoffs for, you know, what makes severe or not severe, but he did say that, and Colburn has told us this before too, Paul, this we need to have an orchidometer. Paul, as a physical exam guy, do you have an orchidometer?
Not yet. I'm asking Nora to Google it for me so I can order.
Nora, did you Google orchidometer?
Not yet, but I will.
I guess Beats. It's not as relevant to your, yeah. I guess
we have him Beats Clinic. We have him Beats Clinic. So.
You do? Okay. So the one other thing he said was that that Klinefelter's which is XXY karyotype, he said that it's present about one in 500 to every 500 to 600 men. So if you have a panel of a couple thousand people, you might have two or three cases in your panel. And these men are typically tall, gynecomastia. The testes volume, if you have an orchidometer, would be like less than 4 cc's. And 15 cc's or more is a normal. So this is quite low size. And he said, you know, the physical exam and the history, sometimes they present with fertility concerns or concerns about puberty. And so think about that. But the main part of the talk was more talking about like our common patients that come in asking us for testosterone replacement therapy. And we'll have to revisit a full episode on this, Paul, I think. But I did want to just talk about the formulations that the IM versions of testosterone, they cause this big peak that can be like a super physiologic spike. And depending on the formulation, it can occur like a week or so later. But that is a formulation. And one of the IM formulations is actually the cheapest formulation, which I wasn't aware of because I'm mostly prescribing gel. He said the gel was marketed as if, oh yeah, it's just, it gives you a more steady levels, but actually the levels on the gel look like a seismograph. They're like all over the place when they actually studied it, because he said there's so many factors like how quickly the person showers or goes swimming after they put the gel on, and are they exercising and getting more blood flow to the muscle, so it's absorbing differently. So there's just so many factors. So the levels are really variable, but we should still check this morning testosterone, 7 to 10 a.m., preferably fasting, and that's how you can go.
You said something when we were prepping for this about like young men when they're asking about their early morning and the range.
Yes. So when you have these healthy young men coming in and saying, oh yeah, I looked online and my testosterone of 300 something is low, I have the testosterone of an 80-year-old, you can tell them actually the normal range of testosterone that is reported in the lab is based on healthy young men. So if you're in that range, then you have the testosterone of a healthy young man. So he's not being aggressive about treating that. He did say that not every patient loves that answer. He also said that for eugonadal men who start testosterone therapy, about 60% of them seem like they stop within the first year. So even if they start it, I think because it's not this, you know, miracle cure that everyone thinks it is coming into the office asking for it, a lot of people maybe decide it's not worth it once they actually get on it. So that's all I had to say about that. Nora, I think you're our final presenter. And what are you getting into?
I went to a bunch of great sessions, some overlap with my colleagues over here as well. But I started the day with how to treat the toughest bugs, in which Dr. Paul Pottinger talked about antimicrobial resistance and kind of best practices, both inpatient and outpatient management for treatment of some of these. The one that he spent the most time on was MRSA, which we see both in the inpatient and the outpatient setting. And one pearl that he brought up was differentiating between community-associated and hospital-associated MRSA. Community-associated, we think of more as the kind of skin and soft tissue infection, abscesses, and then hospital-associated is the more severe, really more resistant generally. So much more rarely MRSA-associated pneumonias and bloodstream infections. But he said in this day and age, even though we may have thought about hospital-associated MRSA infections as being the majority of the hospitalized MRSA infections, actually most of the MRSA infections that we see, even on the inpatient setting, are going to be community acquired. So I think that was useful and a good reminder for me. Also, advised and recommended using the nasal swab, which many of us use in the inpatient setting more often than the outpatient setting, but as a good tool that has a really high negative predictive value to tell you whether or not something is MRSA and peel off MRSA coverage in particular, especially obviously with clinical improvement. So he did say this with the caveat that the MRSA nasal swab should not supersede your clinical judgment. And so if you have a high pretest probability of and clinical suspicion for a MRSA pneumonia, then a negative nasal swab should not prompt you to take off.
Right. Which would be somebody cavitary lesion or necrotic pneumonia. Okay.
The other two things that I found really interesting in his talk, one was about tetracycline testing, which on antibiograms and the susceptibility from cultures, you'll often see tetracycline susceptibility, which obviously, I don't know about you guys, but we're not using tetracyclines all that much.
Yeah, I always thought that just meant it was susceptible to doxycycline.
Which, so you can actually interpret it, but it's not a perfect correlate. And so the pearl that he mentioned in his talk was that if something is tetracycline susceptible, then you can trust that means that it is doxycycline susceptible. But if something is tetracycline resistant, then you should ask the lab for doxycycline susceptibilities or minocycline susceptibilities, because not all cultures that are tetracycline resistant will actually be doxycycline resistant. And so you may still be able to use doxycycline or minocycline.
That's useful. The first time he told me that, I had it the other way around. So that's much easier to deal with.
Yeah. So basically, just if something is listed as being tetracycline resistant, ask for doxy susceptibilities, because you may still be able to use it. And it's a great antibiotic. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing from this talk was just a useful clinical tool to try to understand penicillin allergy. And it's called Pallergy, and we'll link to it in the show notes. But it's a kind of nice clinical decision-making tool like the PenFast. But you can enter in the history. It takes about a minute, he said, to collect the information from patients. It's just like what the antibiotic was that they had a reaction to, what the reaction was. If they don't remember what the reaction was, that's fine. It'll still give you recommendations about what you can and can't use for patients. So we'll link to that. I also went to the allergy testing and primary care session with Dr. John Kelso, and he also had a bunch of useful clinical pearls. The first set was relating to serum-specific IgE testing to look for like food allergies and then allergies to other things in the environment. One of his recommendations was don't send these panels, because you'll get information you don't know what to do with about random allergens.
Has this ever happened to you, Paul?
I've never ordered it.
I've never ordered it.
The patient would be like, yeah, they tested this. Can you please interpret this? I'd be like, Yeah, it seems bad.
Yeah.
I've done it before, and because they test like 40 different
right,
things.
Right, exactly.
And a lot of
no
them
idea
not,
what to do.
And they're not actionable, right. A lot of them.
Right.
Yeah, you're allergic to the South American yew tree. I'm like, okay,
yeah.
Great. I'm not
yeah,
excited.
Like, is that here? Yeah.
It's like an incidentaloma, basically.
Right, exactly. And so that kind of leads to his next recommendation, which is think about what you're ordering before you order it. Which is kind of common sense.
Like dog hair or something.
Yeah, so
like
if someone comes in and says, I am sneezing a lot around my neighbor's dog, then test for
an
allergy to a dog.
Okay.
And then kind of on that note, don't test for like food allergies that are either not clinically correlated or that you know the patient, they won't want to follow the instruction to stop eating something anyway.
Okay.
So mostly common sense there. He did say that you shouldn't be doing total IgE testing because the total IgE level is not predictive of atopy and allergic reactions. So you should really be doing like specific IgE as opposed to the total level. And he went through the different types of hypersensitivities to medications and talked at some length about how to delabel patients and how to get rid of that penicillin allergy and the fact that not everyone needs to be referred to allergy for that. And specifically said, you know, if patients had a non-serious reaction or if they don't really remember it but weren't hospitalized, didn't have any systemic signs or symptoms, didn't have a really bad skin rash like SJS, TEN, that required them to be hospitalized, anything like that, then it's probably safe. And the majority of patients, it's actually safe to proceed to an oral amoxicillin challenge in your own office. And so that involves giving 250 milligram just PO oral amoxicillin, having them observed for an hour just sitting in the office.
Make sure you have an EpiPen.
Yeah. Good point. And then as long as they're okay, they can leave and they should just tell you if they have develop any symptoms or rash. And
you can totally protocolize this with this workflow. You know, my branch of Cashtech Children's Hospital, that our allergist had us do this because obviously they can't take care of all these patients. But
yeah,
it was very important for our pediatric allergists to really get delabel these kids early on.
Do you know what you have over there? Like what do you have to have safety wise? Like, do you have to have just like crash cart and that's it?
No, just EpiPens.
Just EpiPens. Yeah. Okay. All right. We have to leave early because we're going to hang out with some patrons from our Patreon. And if you're not on there, then you're missing out.
No.
Sorry.
This could be catastrophic. We'll see how it goes. This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
I didn't even give our assembled guests a chance to do it. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon, hang out with us, get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback, so please email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. You can subscribe, rate, and review us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to our whole team, Nora, Molly, Chris, Rahul, I guess Paul as well, for helping to write and produce this episode. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chumanchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And I've been Dr. Molly Hoyblein.
I've been Dr. Rahul Ganatra.
This has been Chris the Chumanchu.
I've been Dr. Nora Toronto.
And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.